Jamie Tiemann, I got you on the Capital Razor show. It's been so long since we've been trying to get you on. We finally got you on here, so I'm really excited. This is going to be fun. How the heck are you?
I'm good. I'm doing really, really good. I'm excited about what's happening over the next couple quarters. So.
Okay, cool. So I'm not sure how much of my audience knows who you are. They should know who you are. I've heard you on Clubhouse, and you've kind of astounded me on a number of occasions talking about things that I have not really studied too much when it comes to the capital raising. Let me ask you this. Have you raised for stuff that's not real estate? Have you raised for any like venture capital or any like when you're raising for a startup business or something like that? Have you done any of that?
Or a seed round or anything like that? I have a little bit, but that was for my prop tech company and it's just from friends and family. So it's not like I went out and did like a Series A or a seed round or anything like that. Yeah.
See, when you start saying things like Series A, I don't know what that means. Like all I know is 506C and B and regulation A a little bit and regulation crowdfunding. But you're talking about different stuff. As soon as you start saying that, I don't even know how to repeat it, what you just said. What are some of those legalities before we go into your background? Like what kind of legal structures are you talking about here when you bring up those terminologies?
It's real similar. So you're raising money for a company. And so it's kind of similar to real estate. And the fact Series A is you generally like there's pre-seed round, which is basically kind of what I did. It's like from friends and family, people who need to help me get the, and a lot of it was my own money getting the company started. And then your seed round is your very, very first round. And then they start lettering them like A, B, C, D, E. And so when you get to those, that's just rounds of capital that you have coming into your business. And they're all structured differently. It's kind of similar in the real estate world. And the fact that you'll have a PPM, you'll kind of tell them what kind of shares of the company you're willing to give them, all those different things. But as a company, for a company capital raising, you don't want to be hanging out past like a Series E. There's something wrong. Like if you have to keep raising money from other people, that means you have not sustained a business operation that should be making money sustaining itself. So when you get into later and later rounds, it's like, okay, why are they not making money yet? Basically, it's kind of the concept, but the early, so my stuff for my prop tech company was like pre-seed. It was just friends and family and myself. Like basically put money into the company and we have shares of the company. That's what it is.
So. Okay. And what we're talking about here are exemptions that allow you to raise capital without being a full-blown stock company. Yeah. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Let's actually chat a little bit about this. I know that you're not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer. But essentially, when a syndicator or real estate investor sponsor wants to go and raise capital, right, they basically do so by filing an exemption that says, hey, I'm allowed to raise capital either from friends and family or in some cases, accredited investors. We won't go into too much about that. But each time that these investor sponsors do this, they're essentially filing for an exemption that allows them to raise capital legally. Is this correct?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what your Regulation D it kind of is. And so you have several different forms of Reg D that you can use in order to file for your exemption, and they each have their own set of rules. So the most commons are 506B, obviously, and 506C. And the difference between the two is basically who you can take money from and what they have to know. And do they have to have a pre-existing relationship with you? So 506B is basically you got to know them before you have the deal. And knowing like it's very vague.
Everything is very vague. It's lawyer talk.
Desi's like, how do you know then? Like, and I've had people say, we've had a pre-existing relationship because they emailed me and asked me to be on my investor list. So that determined the relationship prior to. So
yeah, here's what I know. As soon as you have a deal that you're starting to raise for from that date that you launched that, you can no longer bring on people that you do not have an existing relationship with.
Yeah, so exactly. That's
key. And then just, we talked about this on the last show that I did. I kind of want to be very clear that as if you're doing joint ventures or small multifamilies, as soon as you have somebody that gives you money that is not participating in some kind of ongoing duty, whether that be decision-making, choosing the color of the paint, or some kind of ongoing thing that they have to be a part of, whether that's investor relations or underwriting or finding the deal, anything that they're just like, here's my money, you manage it. At that point, it becomes a syndication. And all that really means is that there's somebody in there that is completely passive. And according to regulation, you have to basically be treated like a stock or a security at that point, because somebody is giving you their money and has no control over the deal. So just for the small joint venture guys out there, I know that you guys are coming up and scaling into large syndications and stuff. A lot of people say, oh, I syndicated my fourplex, and really they didn't. Just understand this one thing and then we'll move on, is as soon as somebody is not doing anything other than giving you their money, it is now referred to as syndication. If everybody's participating, that is not a syndication. Okay.
Thing you want to add to is like, and what, when you determine that that's a syndication, you have so many regulatory things. Even if you get an exemption from the SEC, you have a fiduciary duty to your investors that is now born. You have regulations around verifying that they're sophisticated or they're not sophisticated. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you have, by setting it up that way, that's what happens. And so you just got to be real, real careful not to get yourself in a pickle and all sorts of great bad
things. Okay, cool. This is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to chat a lot about different things regarding capital raising. But before we go down that road, let's kind of start a little bit with your background, Amy.
Okay.
Who are you?
Who am I? So I'm a former general contractor. I was a GC building retail stores. I started in commercial construction in 2003. And I was building retail stores kind of all across the United States. I was in 16 states at one point. And along that journey, going from my first store, first project, to when we were in the 16th state, we started real estate investing and started by a single home flipping, single family residence flipping. And then, because every GC becomes a house flipper at some point. Hmm. And then I got into single family rentals, and then we got into multifamily and kind of just went from there. So I've been in multifamily investing since 2010. So I've been doing it for a little while. And now I do buy an office building, and I've got multifamily investments all across the state of Texas. And I'm actively capital raising. I'm starting my first fund this year. So right, yeah, right, busy on. Girl.
Okay, cool. Let's go back into this particular moment in history. I really like to dive into when people are transitioning from single family or small multis or joint ventures into the world of syndication. I think a lot of people, maybe a percentage of my audience, wants to either scale their capital mm-hmm. raising business in multifamily or wants mm-hmm. to become an active syndicator. And they have to go through this process of talking to a lawyer and learning the laws and
yep.
preventing themselves from conditioning the market and making mistakes that could get them in trouble. But for you, when you uh-huh. decided to go from single family, or more or less around this point of time in history, into the world of syndication, what was that process like for you? What did you decide to study in terms of, were you a full-blown capital raiser at this point, or you just kind of did your general contracting thing and then people found out about you and gave you capital? How did that work?
So I was actually in one of those mastermind groups, and I had been in it for a long time. So I was a limited partner in probably six or seven deals. And I bought an apartment complex outright out of my own investments from a single families. And so I had a lot of investing experience, but when you're a limited partner, you're in there with a bunch of other investors. When we started, so we were the limited partner on the job, but then we were also the GC. So we came in and we renovated like the apartment. So I was an active passive. I was weird. Like, I was there day one doing demo and takeover and doing all these different things because I was the general contractor on the job and we're also a limited partner. So transitioning from single family and multifamily fell in that kind of a realm, but I was in a mastermind group. I was talking to other investors. They were looking for deals. We had a group before anybody bought their first deal. We had a group that would meet every month and we would underwrite multifamily deals, and some person would like volunteer to be the guinea pig, and they would go find a deal like on LoopNet or whatever. And even though we weren't going to buy it, they were just underwriting it. They would take what the broker gave them and we would underwrite it. And then we would present it out to the group and then we would like pick it apart. So that's how we figured out how to make offers on deals and do whatever. So that group, a lot of sponsors were born. And out of that, our little mastermind group, there's a lot of them that were born. And then we were a part of another larger group. So that's how I syndicated my first deal. I raised all the money out of that group. And my first raise was $1.5 million. So I went and bought small portfolio of multifamily properties down in Corpus Christi. That's kind of how I did my first syndication, was that way.
Interesting. When you were putting your first syndication together, what kind of conversations did you need to have with lawyers? Were you involved with that whatsoever? Did you outsource that?
No, I was involved with all of that. So I had a lawyer who did both the real estate side and the SEC side, and they were recommended by the other folks in the group. So that's the lawyer I choose. I chose a lot of the vendors and a lot of those folks from people from in the group that had previously used them. So there was a lot of, and obviously I was the general contractor, so I knew how to do the CapEx budgets and all that other stuff, but the SEC attorneys and the real estate attorneys and the insurance guy. And then there's like probably 20 parties to get a commercial real estate transaction done. There's probably like 20 of them. And they're all folks that were recommended to me from this group. It made it fairly simple to get through the transaction because I had so many resources available to me. They set up the PPM. They set up the process on how I get. Now, I didn't have a portal at this time because I'm ancient and like they didn't have portals back then because I'm old. So I was risque. I was using Dropbox because the documents are so huge. I'm like, I can't email this to you. So I was using secure Dropbox locations for the documents and having them go in and sign them and uploading it back up in the Dropbox. So I was pre-portal using Dropbox. And now everybody's got a portal and everybody, you know, everybody, their brother's got a portal and then their accountant's got a portal and then their dog's got a portal. Like everybody's got a portal. But before I was old school, like I had to do it through email and Dropbox. So yeah, it was interesting. We had to like number your PPMs. You actually had to write a number on your PPM. Like it was crazy. They would write a PPM, they had a blank, and then you're like, this is PPM number 202. And this is who I sent. And I sent that PPM to this person. Like, no joke. Like it was crazy. Just so you could keep track of where your PPMs were. And so I had an Excel spreadsheet with like PPM numbers and cross-referenced by people I sent them to. Oh, I was crazy back then trying to capital raise. And this was like 2017. You'd think I'd be talking like 50 years ago. No, this was like 4 years ago. It was like this. There were no portals back then.
It's a good opportunity to give a shout out to Syndication Pro. We do a little bit of a series where we talk about all of the things that you just mentioned and the problems that people have if they don't have a portal. Anyways, moving forward, I kind of want to touch on this particular thing because I've been in contact with a few people that are GCs that are not capital partners that are looking for a partner. We're in the middle of a 506C accredited investor only offering for a built to rent project. And people have been receiving emails and they're saying to themselves, I'm a contractor. I have never been paid as a general partner. I'm just like the dude that gets paid to do the work. And then they're realizing that they're not creating passive income or generational wealth. And they want to own a piece of the property. And these guys typically are introverted or don't know anything about raising capital, or they're very good at their specific thing. But they need to start raising capital if they want to, or partner with capital raisers or fund managers or some source of equity to get across the finish line in such a way where they are part owners. I kind of want to ask you this. Do you have any advice? I don't know if you just kind of stumbled your way into syndication this way, but a lot of general contractors don't. They just kind of do their duty and never become part owners of the company. Somebody that's in this situation that may be listening today, do you have any advice for them on like how to start aligning with the capital sources now to become part of the GP team, of the general partnership team?
I would say that they should start as a limited partner like I did and buy shares, like invest in the deal that you're operating as a contractor on. Because there is a conflict of interest when you're a general partner and you're also the contractor on the job. Is a conflict of interest there, and it can be perceived bad by investors. And there are a lot of them that do it. I used to do it too, but now I don't perform as the GC. What I perform a role is as construction manager because I was a GC for a long time. So I'm not getting the bulk of the CapEx dollars coming in funneling into my company. I don't do that. I see that as a conflict of interest. Inherently, the investors should have that duty separated, especially on my value add jobs where the CapEx dollars are quite substantial. Like some of them are in the millions of dollars. So I don't generally like to do that, nor so suggest that they do that. But if they want to come in and maybe be something like me where they're a general partner, but they're doing construction management and not getting all the CapEx dollars, that would be a great role for them to play. So they're still going to farm it out. They're still going to have subs. They're going to see what it, but the money's not coming to them personally. There's some folks, like as old school, people used to do it. I GC'd a job one time on one of my deals and it worked out okay because I had the best interest of my investors at heart, but I can see how GCs could use it and pad their things and look at that CapEx budget. And then, oh, I've got $9,000 a turn, but I can do a turn for $3,000 and give myself $6,000 in my pocket. You can see how that can happen. And so there's risk there. So I just tell them not to do it. But their skill set is very much needed on the GP. It's very much needed on the GP team. So if you want to start as an LP, do one or two deals as limited part. Maybe you're the GC on the job, but you're kicking back money in as the LP. So then you're starting to get financial reports. You're kind of see all the other components to running a property and what that looks like and what you need to read. And if you're doing consistent financial reports as a contractor, hopefully they are, not every GC does. But if you're doing consistent financial reports as a contractor, then when you start doing financial reports as a property manager or running a property, there's a lot of similar things there. There's a lot of nuances, but they look fairly similar. So as long as you're used to reading financial reports, then you should be okay. And then when you get on the GP side, my suggestion to avoid the conflict of interest is just run as a construction manager and offer that as your service. Like, I will construction manage for you for a small fee, be upfront investors, you know, it's like 2% of the thing or whatever it might be, but that's my role as the GP. That's what I'm going to charge a fee for because it is a lot of work. It's not like it's not, it is, it's a lot of work. And some GPs will charge even more than that, but it is a lot of work to construction manage a CapEx project. So that would be my suggestion on how they do it. And they could do that now, as long as they're not feeding it through their construction company. They could offer that to somebody that as a sponsor or whoever it might be, that they could do that for a small portion of the GP. They might have to start in smaller, like I want to just be a member of the GP and let me charge a construction management fee. And then I can do that for you. And that might be helpful, especially for those GPs that don't know construction or the ones that think they, even the ones that they think they know construction. There's lots of those.
Tell me about this transition from being a GC. I think you were doing GC on the houses and then got into small multifamily. You transitioned into multifamily. Tell me about when you started to realize that you had some skill set when it came to raising capital. Is this the majority of your business today, by the way? Is capital raising the majority of your business?
Yeah,
it is.
And well, I'm a full-time sponsor and capital raiser. So that's kind of what I do now. So that's all I do. I capital raise for other deals. That's not a lot of what I do. Normally I'm capital raising for my deals. So, or deals that I find. I might do it for one or two sponsors that I really like, but normally it's for my deals. So transitioning from one to the other is the biggest hurdles you're going to find is communication. You have to have communication channels. You have to inherently have them. You have to build a sales funnel with your investors. You have to have a CRM. You have to have all these processes and systems in place so that you can do investor management very effectively. And you have to be networking all the time. And then you have to have lead generation. You have to have good lead generation systems and like just getting folks through the sales funnel and just curating those investors and doing all these stuff. And then after you actually get a deal done, then you got all the communication that goes to those investors for that deal, communicating all the time. I mean, yep. I feel constantly sending out emails to somebody. Like at some point I'm updating them on a deal or I'm sending out a deal alert or I'm sending out some sort of educational thing, or I'm sending them a video on this or doing that. So you're constantly in marketing mode. And I suck at marketing. Like I'm horrible. So I go find people who are really good at it and I hire them because I'm not a designer. Don't ask me to design anything. My website would probably suck if I did it. Like I don't want to do any of that. I need to hire that. But when you're first starting out, no one has money for that. So you kind of have to fumble your way through it. So being in a group is helpful because then you don't have to have all that stuff in order to do it. But eventually, if you want to go big time and you want to do some of that kind of stuff, you have to have those systems in place. The investors are going to expect it out of you. Yes, and especially getting larger check sizes where you're going asking family offices or you're going asking high net worth individuals for a larger and larger check, whether that, even if that's larger to you is 100K or larger to you is 2 million, they all have different expectations and different preferences on how you communicate to them, how you treat them, how you talk to them. It's an interesting world. And so that was the biggest thing I had to learn. And I've been learning that for 5 or 6 years now. And the other thing I had to learn was, so my first deal I got into in Corpus, was hit by Hurricane Harvey. So everybody thinks Hurricane Harvey went to Houston and it decimated Houston, which it did. But the epicenter was actually Corpus Christi. Like, it hit there first, and then it took a right turn and sat on Houston and poured a bunch of rain. But it hit, Harvey hit in Corpus. So my property, I had just like was acquiring that property and it got hit by Hurricane Harvey. So for me to honor my investors, I kind of hunkered down and I stayed there and I worked through all the issues and I did all these different things and I like did all that, but I stopped marketing myself. And because I was so focused on that one investment, I didn't go get any other investments. I didn't do anything else. I just stayed put on that one deal to make sure that that sucker worked. I was going to like make sure that they didn't lose any money. And it was tough. It was hard. It was horrible. It was, I went through like 2 roofers and 4 painters and 3 siding guys, and everybody would flake on you at the last minute. And like all this stuff, because they would chase an insurance job and then trying to get material. Oh, hell. It's like, you think materials are bad now, trying to get material is like the same as that what happened in Hurricane Harvey. It was horrible. And so I had to manage through all of that stuff. So I stopped marketing. And because I stopped marketing, when I finally survived and got out of that and tried to go raise capital again, nobody knew who I was.
Right. I know exactly.
Nobody had any idea who Amy Thiemann is. They were like, who are you? Like, really? I don't even know who you are. And then I had to learn it takes a long, 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 long time to build your brand. And then I started marketing when I was trying to buy something, was during the pandemic, of course, because let's do something else challenging. And so then I had to like market myself differently. And I had to learn about social media. I didn't know what Instagram was, really. I still barely know Instagram. I finally got a social media consultant to do my Instagram because I was like, But you had to learn how to do it differently and completely change and redraw your blueprint and everything. It was insane. So from like, say, March of 20, where I had to pivot and figure it out, till now, I finally feel like now I finally have got momentum. So it's like, what, 1.5 years later? Like, really? It's like, it takes you that long of being consistent in marketing, getting on conferences, getting on people's stages, being maniacal about being on. And I haven't been maniacal. It's probably taken me, it probably would have only taken me 6 months had I been maniacal about it on social media, but I wasn't, because it took me a while to kind of figure out where I needed to be. That was interesting.
Branding, marketing, the social media to some extent, definitely the communication. They're all really huge pieces of the capital raising part. You mentioned something, I kind of want to go back a little bit on something that you mentioned, which was like, hey, when you're raising from family offices or institutions, when I started the show, the only money that I had ever raised was from joint venture partners into small multifamilies. And I got into syndication and I kind of got my way into the door by saying, oh, you know, I used to raise capital on social media, on YouTube, doing videos of stuff that I used to do on fourplexes and how we did this, that, and the other. And when I moved into syndication, I realized that the way that you raise from limited partners is definitely very different than the ways that you raise from joint venture partners. And the expectation of communication is extensively different. And you can't raise from people today that you didn't talk to and plant seeds with yesterday. So my first many shows were about raising from limited partners. And then I found out about these things called institutions and pref equity and family offices and raising from broker dealers and all these other ways to raise capital. You mentioned some of them. Family office, I think, was the one that you said. Tell me about some of the things that you learned along the way about the differences of raising one style of capital raise, maybe what the different types of capital raises are. Give us some expertise or at least some input into those different groups that you can raise money from.
Kind of the rule of thumb is the larger the check, the more they want control over your deal.
Right.
And which is fair. Like if there's someone's going to write a $5 million check for your entire equity raise, they're going to change your operating agreement. So you just went to the attorney to spend all this money to write this operating agreement for your lovely little syndication. And they go, oh, that's BS. And we're going to change it all. And I'd change it anyway. So before you go, when you've got a deal, before you go spend all this money on a PPM and an operating agreement and all those other things, figure out who your capital source is going to be, because you're going to waste your money. You got to understand, like, if you are going to go to like a fund or somebody like that, who's going to write you a check, they're going to have a lawyer, and the lawyer's going to probably have a template or operating agreement they like. And it could be very different. I've seen folks that go, oh yeah, yeah, we're really LP. We really are. We're not going to control your stuff. Yeah, whatever. They will tell you when to refi. They will tell you when to sell. They don't like your property manager. They'll tell you to change them. If they don't, I mean, they're just going to, who has the gold makes the rules. Just know that. So when you're in syndication mode, none of that happens. You're the sponsor. You control everything. You're gathering a bunch of different little people, little checks here, like 50, 100K, 200K, whatever, but they don't have managing, controlling interest of your deal. When you go get a larger check like that, they do. But it's okay as long as you develop a good relationship. But some people structure it even like this, where they'll come in and say, okay, we're going to write your whole equity check, maybe 90% of your equity check. We want you to put 10% in.
Right.
And then they'll go, but the promote splits will change. In the first year, whatever the distributions are, we're getting 80 and you're getting 20. And then for the next 2 years, it's going to be like that. And then it might go to 70-30. And then by year five, it might go to 60-40. So they're going to incentivize you to do well, but they're going to recoup a lot of their interest in the, it's like, I don't know, like a lender, like where they get, it's all mostly in, the interest is front loaded. They're doing the same thing. So it just depends on who you want to get in bed with. Like who do you want to pick as your equity source, but try to know that going in on how you're going to go raise your capital, because how you raise your capital will determine what you spend in legal fees. And sometimes with those guys, you don't need to spend the legal fees because they already got their lawyers anyway, and they're going to write the agreement. So you don't have to. You think anybody can go, I've done enough LLCs now. I don't need an attorney to go file my LLC paperwork for me. I can write it on my own and go down to the state and file it for like $300 or whatever it is. It's a real six thing and it's not hard. And you can go get your EIN through the IRS. Like it's, the organizational stuff is not awful. You can do that. And they're going to write your operating agreement for you if you choose to partner with them. So that's kind of the, some of the stuff you need to know when you get start getting larger and larger checks. Now, family offices are varying sizes. Some of them aren't going to write your whole equity check. Some of them are just going to, I have a guy who owns, has a family office and he signs on all my loans for me. He's fabulous. He's great. He's got a big balance sheet. It's great. I'm like, yes. He's the reason why I'm able to go get the loans I'm able to get, because he's got a big balance sheet and he covers all ills. He covers everybody. He's worth a lot of money. And he's signed on like $400 million of loans. Like he's just a good dude. And if you need experience in any sort of asset class, this dude's got it. Like, it's great. I'm like, oh, I'm so happy I have you on my team. So as far as capital raising from some family offices, they play different roles. And some of them will, but, and some of them will demand, I want this out of the deal. Like, I'll be in the GP, but I want a certain percentage of the GP, which is okay. As long as you show them the business plan and you show them the promote and you show them all these different things, which is fine. And institutions, they're a whole other ball of wax. I've talked to insurance companies who want to be investors. Yep. And so, I've talked to some
Let's stop there real quick, because we've only mentioned it once or twice in previous shows. Did you guys know, audience members, that you can actually raise from insurance companies? It's not very common, but they have money that they need to park in real estate, and multifamily is a great asset for them. Yeah. I just want to plant that seed. We won't go into it in too many details. I want to kind of mention a couple of things that I've heard on the show, talking to different sponsors, and then I'll ask you to provide some feedback or add to what I just say. So some sponsors, especially newer sponsors, they are transitioning from the world of single family. And the way that they raised there was, if the deal is good enough, the money will come. And I think when you're talking about less than $1 million, or particularly under $500,000, that can definitely be true. But what a lot of people do is they transition into multifamily and then realize that they have to start communicating and establishing a limited partner database. And like you said, it takes a long time and requires marketing and a lot of networking and ongoing participation in speaking to people and communicating with people. And your choices, like when you're started or getting into the world of syndication or moving up in syndication, is to build this large database of limited partners that invest $50,000 to $250,000 each. Right. And this can take a very long time. If you don't have that database, it's going to be very challenging to raise. It's not the right time to start a fund, by the way, if you're in this situation. And the benefits of raising this way is you have a great deal of control. If you do build that database, you have a great deal of control. The people are passive. They don't ask for a lot of things. You communicate with them. You give them a good return. You be a good steward of their money. Everything is peachy. Now, if you move into the world of borrowing large institutional or family office checks, like you mentioned, these guys want to control. So now you lose your acquisition fees. They beat up your underwriting. If there's some kind of a fee or something that you charge, these are Wharton MBAs that manage a family's money, that are saying, why is this expense different than what you projected it to be? And they're kind of in your face about it. And it's very challenging. But the benefit is if you can create a relationship with somebody and have a business model that they like, all of a sudden you don't have to deal with 50 investors. You get one check and you're done. Or maybe you have a 10% equity share that you do, or if you find somebody that does pref equity, they'll cover the majority and then raise the additional capital from their sources. I've heard about that too. So the benefit is like you can scale a lot faster. You just can't get as much money or be as profitable. And if it's more important to you to be scaling and get that momentum, then family office, if you're doing deals that are big enough, may be the way to go. But now you have to deal with the headache of somebody micromanaging you and cutting out your fees. So far, are you in agreement with what I said? Does this resonate with you?
Yeah. And the other thing too, is they're going to be very, very picky about you. Mm-hmm. So it's not, everybody thinks, oh, if I got a great deal, I'll find the money. No, you have to have a great track record. And if you don't, you better go find somebody who does, because no one's going to invest with you. And family office is not only that, they're not just picky about you. They want to know you have a team. They want to know that they're going to be able to get their financial statements on time. You cannot be late with your financial statements. If you say you're going to get them out by the 15th, they by golly better be there on the 14th at 4 p.m.
Yeah.
You cannot be late with your financial statements. So that means I cannot be doing the financial statements and the asset management and finding deals and investor relations and whatever, and I cannot be doing it because that's not sustainable to them. So they're going to say, who's on your team? What roles do they play? All these other different things. And so I have a fairly good team. So it's nice. So I'm like, no, I don't do financial statements. I have somebody who has 30 years of experience as a CPA. They do them. And you don't want them for me. And they have people on their team. And we get the financials from the property management company. And then we all roll it up into an asset management accounting. And we have all systems. And they want to know that you're for real. They don't want you like a solopreneur trying to knock down a $10 million deal. First of all, it's too small for them. But like insurance companies, just so you know, when you get into larger and larger deals, insurance companies, the ones I've talked to, the actual check they want to write you, the minimum size is $25 million. That's what they want to write. That means that that's the LP side. That means you're buying a $100 million asset. That's the asset size that you're buying. And there's some like that. And there's class A, and they're probably 400 to 500 units in really hot markets that's one asset, and it could probably be $100 million. That's the stuff that they want, or a portfolio stuff or whatever it might be. But you just got to know that about that. But they have stringent requirements, and don't miss your financial deadline. Don't do it. And they get enough deal flow. They find enough people that will pass some deals. Not as much as lower you go down, the more deal flow there is, because they have obviously not every deal size is 100 million or more. There's only a few of those, but they are very, very picky about who, and family offices are too. Mm-hmm. And, if it's not just institutions, family offices are too. Who's on your team? How long have you been doing it? And right now the environment is they do team first. They look at the team first. They don't even look at the deal.
As they should. Yeah. And a couple other things to take note of. Some of these big check writers are going to want to have the ability and write it into a contract saying that if you misperform, they can kick you out.
Yeah.
The other thing to be aware of, if you're going for these big checks, is that sometimes the people that you're talking to are not the actual check writers, but they may be gatekeepers, and they have access to people that have access to the money, but they're not really the people that have the money. And you may end up putting some money down on something and then not actually get the check, which could absolutely destroy your deal. The other thing that a lot of people should be aware of is when you have a person that has the ability to write a big check, they can walk away from your deal if they have nothing on the line. So you may want to say, hey, participate with me on the earnest money deposit. So that way I know you're not going to bounce 5 days before closing with your money to find something that's a lot more lucrative than my deal. So these things to keep in mind, guys, just if you ever want to go down that direction, I think we might scale up there one day. I'm not there by any means now, but it's the stuff that I hear on my show quite a bit.
Yeah, you close your investment window a lot sooner. So your investment window closes 30 days before you close on the deal. So that's kind of how you mitigate some of that, is like, I got to have your money in by X date because we're closing 30 days after. And that's normal. That's okay. And they know that game. That's fine. And they're usually, if it's a family office, sometimes they want to be a part of the GP. Sometimes they don't. It just kind of depends. But if they're a part of the GP and they like you, they'll go call their other family office buddies and they'll help you raise money. So like once you get in with a family office that kind of likes you, then your capital raising kind of gets a little better and a little easier. Once you get to understand what the game is and you play the game well, then things get a little easier for you.
Cool. So let's talk about why you want to start a fund. Maybe we should go into like, how have you scaled to the point where you even want to start a fund?
I have enough deal flow right now that it necessitates a fund. I've got enough stuff coming my way, enough deals that make sense to me, and I'm having to capital raise for deals simultaneously. So I've got deals that I have. It's not like I can buy one and then wait and then I got another one and then wait and then I got another one right now. Mm. I've got so many deals coming my way that make sense that I don't want to miss out on those opportunities. And because I don't want to miss out those opportunities, it's feeling like I need to have a fund so that I can just go jump on them. And so as they come along, because I have the ability to scale now that I'm not property managing anymore, I can asset manage and I'll like hire asset managers as I even grow out of that role. And I have good property management teams. I think that's just kind of how I'm going to kind of scale. So a fund allows you to have a little more flexibility to go jump on, be very opportunistic on deals as they come across, because you're able to close faster than everybody else because you have the capital sitting there. And as long as you've got good debt sources, which I already do, my biggest deal is like, I don't have a problem getting debt. And remember, I got Dr. Moneybag there, who's my family office dude. So I can get debt. That's not a problem. It's just every time I go get a deal, now I'm raising X amount of dollars and I wait until I get the deal through whatever. And then it's the race. I'm tired of doing the race. So I'm thinking, this is my thought process in my head. It's just like, okay, let's just start a fund. And then let's like have, and we can do capital calls as we get commitments from people and we can, because the deal flow is there and that's not slowing down for me right now.
I want a word of caution for the GC who has never raised capital before. They may think, I've heard this from a couple of people on phone calls recently, oh, if I start a fund, the money will just be sitting there waiting for me to use it. I could do it. Okay. So don't think that just because you go and start a fund that you'll be able to raise money and then go use that money and that people are just going to let it sit there, not earning interest while you're going and doing your thing. It's not quite that way. So definitely talk to some people and make sure that you're doing the right thing. Don't just go to an attorney that will write you docs without really looking at your business plan or give you any business advice and tell you whether or not they think that you can actually raise the capital. Because a lot of attorneys will write you docs and then let you sit with never raising a single penny. So what Amy is talking about is not that. However, I do want to ask you a little bit about, why do you think that people, because you said, hey, you want to be raising all the time. Do you want to have that money sitting in something? Is it soft commits that are just waiting for your deal?
Yeah. I mean, people don't really want to be. Typically, it's soft commits. So you have commits, but I have enough deals that I can call capital. So you don't want the commit sitting out too long. And I think now there's more and more of an investor preference for funds. Like before, like starting a fund, you almost was a popularity contest, truly. Like you had to have a great track record, a great marketing engine. Everybody had to know who you were before they would even think about investing in your fund. But now it's more and more like investors are kind of like, oh yeah, I might invest in a fund. You can maybe get now. Could you, if you're a GC and nobody knows who you are, go do a $5 million fund? Nah, probably not. You probably couldn't even do a syndication. Nobody knows who you are. So it's all track record. It's all track record and marketing. So you have to do, but you do, like you do have soft, say you're going to raise whatever, you have commitments for X, but you don't call a capital until you got a deal. I'm not going to have money sitting in a bank there earning whatever. I'm not going to take their money away from them until I got a deal to put it in. So that's typically how the funds work. And, but I have so many deals right now. I got places to put it in. Like, let's go. Like I've got 3 or 4 deals I got to close by the end of the year. And I've got next quarter, I got 4 more after that. I mean, like I got deals. So that's why I'm starting a fund. So,
okay, cool. Yeah. And then just before we move into the lightning round, just curious about the types of deals that you're doing. Is it value add multifamily, something else? Is it storage? Is it a variety of things?
Yeah, it's value add multifamily. It's value add something. So value add is always a component, anything I do. So I have a value add, lots of value add multifamily. I have a value add office building and I'm looking at some storage. Some dude took a great deal for me. I know him. He's got I know he is, but it took a great deal for me. And that was going to be my first storage deal. I'm asset agnostic. I don't care if it makes money and I can figure it out, because my balance sheet guy allows me to float around into different stuff because he's done so many different asset classes. So I love to do industrial if I could get it, or self storage or anything like that. But I will make sure that I partner with people who know what they're doing, because I don't want to, I'm not going to risk any investor money on stuff from on my learning curve. I mean, that's just stupid, right? So you partner with good people. So yeah.
Let's move into the lightning round. Let's start with this. What's the best vacation you've ever taken, Amy?
The best vacation I've ever taken, I went scuba diving in the Grand Caymans. So that was pretty cool.
All right. Favorite book of any kind?
I'll tell you the latest one I'm reading right now, which you're going to think I'm a total dork. Scaling Up is a great book. And it's by Vern somebody. And he talks about the Rockefeller habits. So I'm trying to scale my organization. He leads you through kind of how you scale an organization. So I like that book a lot. Let me talk about that one.
I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, I'm reading a risk management book too, because I'm such a dork. But Scaling Up is a great book.
Excellent. Next level. Okay, so how about this? Short answer on this. Best way to raise capital from your perspective?
It's still old school. It's networking. Really, truly is. You can do all the social media you want. You can have the coolest website. You can do whatever. But truly, truly, it's networking with people, being in mastermind groups, getting on Zoom calls. It's going to conferences. And besides like networking on crack, being on other people's stages, speaking at events, that provides you so much credibility. It's not even funny. And it allows you to raise capital easier. That's why I get so ticked off at conferences that don't have women on stages, because they are hurting their businesses, because they're not offering them the opportunity to speak in front of people. And that buys you so much runway when you're trying to raise capital or trying to do anything with your business. That's why I beat up people on LinkedIn, like Old Capital, I'll do it again. And Brad Sumrock, I'll do that again, for not having women speak. There you go.
My favorite interviews are with women and minorities. I just love the person that you can root for. How long do you want to live?
120.
Ah, that's pretty much me too, 121. Drink of choice.
It's called a Pink Amy. It's my own creation. It is Deep Eddy Ruby Red Vodka. You get mint leaves, and you put the shot of the ruby red vodka in the mint leaves. And then you model the mint, like you just kind of crush it all. Like, don't get all the leaves, don't go crazy, but just model it so the mint oil gets into the vodka. And then you pull the leaves out, because no one likes a salad in their drink. You put Sprite in it, and then you put it, and you squeeze an orange peel, or like a slice of orange in it. And it's called a Pink Amy, and that's my drink. It's fabulous.
Wow, that sounds pretty good. You're going to have to make me one of those next time we're hanging out. Favorite aspect of being a multifamily investor?
It's the freedom and flexibility that you have in your lifestyle. So the fact that I pick up my kid from school every day, I take them to school, unless I'm traveling or whatever. I can go on vacation when I want to go on vacation. I can go look at properties. I can do this. I just have, for me and my personality type and kind of how I like to live, it's the flexibility and freedom. I could not be a person that sat behind a desk and worked from 8 to 5. Shoot me in the head. I just could not do it. So this provides me the opportunity to meet a lot of people. I'm kind of an extroverted anyway, and so I enjoy meeting a lot of people, but I also enjoy challenges. And I enjoy, on the value add component, because I'm an old GC, I enjoy making stuff pretty. And I enjoy a piece of junk and making it pretty and improving communities. Like, I enjoy all of that. I enjoy being able to drive by later and go, I built that. I built that store right there. Or I did that right there. It's just cool. So that's kind of the stuff I really like.
Excellent. So, do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Yes, very much so.
How so?
When you have a center of grace and a center of faith, obstacles are going to come your way. No matter what you do, they're going to come your way. You just generally know, so I'm a Christian, so you just generally know that because you're a Christian, because God's got your back. So you just know that He wants you to succeed, and if you screw up, you're already forgiven. There's just so many things that you're going to have to face every day. And I cannot imagine facing that not being a Christian. Like, that would be horrible, having to go through life facing all of the shame and the guilt and all the other crap. But I don't have to face that. I just know I'm going to do the right thing. If I screw up, it's inevitable. I'm a sinner, whatever. but I know I'm forgiven and I can get better the next day. But I know that he wants me to succeed. And so because of that, it's kind of what propels me to understand that defeat is temporary and you can get to the next day and keep pushing, because that's how people get successful, because they keep and they don't stop and they don't stop and they don't stop. However you choose to motivate you to do that, mine's is my center of grace, but however you choose to do that, that's what's going to make you successful. And don't beat yourself up when bad things happen, because they're going to happen, and keep going.
You could be a coach. Part of mastery is failure.
So exactly.
Don't worry about it. It's not always, God attempts to create things through you, and that intuition and calling is him wanting, or her wanting, to move through you. So just follow that intuition. Do you have any hacks for breaking through your limiting beliefs?
There's always those like negative voices that you hear. There's this stuff. And usually, because we're human, we'll put a face to that voice, whatever it might be. Maybe it's your parent who was mean to you, or a school teacher who was mean to you, or just negative all the time. Or for me, it's my ex-husband. And like, whatever that face is, that negative voice that tells you you're not good enough, or tells you there's no way you could do that, or you're just a girl. What do you think you're doing? Whatever that is, I do a visualization exercise where I see that person saying that stuff to me, that negative voice, and then I punch it in the face. Awesome. And then I just move on with life. This is not real. This thought that's coming to me, that's telling me, this noise that I keep hearing that's negative, it's not real. And you can choose to listen to it, or you can choose not to listen to it. I choose not to listen to it. But I don't only do that, I visualize it and I punch it in the face. I get to punch my husband in the face a lot sometimes.
So that can be a very effective pattern.
I'm not assaulting him. It's visually, but yes.
Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Yeah, I had a near-death experience once. I was pregnant with my first boy. I was 8 months pregnant and I was driving in Indiana. I was going to school at the time and I was on an icy road and there was a snow plow kind of in front of me. So I was hanging out behind the snow plow and I hit a patch of ice and forget it. And my car went down into a ditch about 40 feet. Like it was an embankment. And I can remember being in the car. I can remember looking out of my windshield and going, why can I not see out of my windshield? Why can I not see out of my, I don't understand. I don't get it. And then I finally figured out I was hanging in my seatbelt. I was upside down because my car had flipped over. And I was hanging in my seatbelt, 8 months pregnant. So I unbuckled the seat. I kept pushing it down below my belly because it would drive me bananas all the time. I was hanging in my seatbelt. I unhooked the seatbelt and I'm down like basically on the top of my car because it's upside down. And the snowplow driver saw me go off. Thank God, because I would have been stuck out there. Nobody would have known I was down there. Like I was crushed in my car. So I'm operating in this little area in my car. He saw me go down and he rushed down there and he's like, are you okay? And then I was like, I don't know, but I'm 8 months pregnant and I don't know. That's kind of what I told him. And it felt like 5 minutes. Everybody was there. I don't know. He must have had a radio connection with somebody. I guess he did. It felt like 5 minutes and everybody was there. They got me out of the car. They had to use it's not like I'm heavy, but they had to use like a winch because it was just, I'm 8 months pregnant. So they're trying to be really careful with carrying me up the 40-foot embankment to get up there. And so I get up there and I finally get to the hospital and the only thing I had on me was, and I had a little scratch on my nose. Like after they cleaned off my face and stuff, I had a little scratch on my nose over my glasses that came down and went, like, that's the only injury I had.
I love asking that question. You get the craziest answers. All right, let's finish off with this. What kind of impact would you like to leave in the world?
So I have a lot of things I'm trying to do because real estate is a really cool thing. So there's a couple of nonprofit things I'm starting. If I had to pick one, I think education is so important because education gets people out of poverty. I think it's the one thing that will help most folks get further in life if they're educated. I think the public school systems need help. And there's in each community that we go into where we have a property that we own, we donate funds to their education foundations. And if they don't have an education foundation supporting their public school, we help them start one. So that's kind of something that I started doing a couple years ago. And the Education Foundation is basically what they do is they give grants to teachers in the schools to do cool projects. They're there to help the schools kind of further their education, where they're stuck with getting money from the state and the federal government. Well, this is a private institution helping them further the academics and all sorts of different projects, but it allows the teachers to be entrepreneurial in a sense and thinking of, okay, maybe we could teach this different way. Let's try this different project. And so I like that whole environment that you're helping with the teachers to kind of think out of the box, because the teacher's thinking out of the box and they're helping the public schools, then everybody wins. The communities get better. And it might be, you can even think it's selfish on my part, but the communities get better because the schools get better, then my properties get better, but that's not what I'm doing. But yeah, that's kind of what we do.
Absolute fire on the lightning round. Thanks for entertaining us on that. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions, my new company. And to our sponsors, Good Egg Investments, Syndication Pro, Kate and Patel Coaching, and Jerome Myers. If you're looking for a capital raiser coach, go to therealestateaccelerator.com. Let them know that you heard about them through the Capital Raiser Show to get $1,000 off their capital raising mentorship program. And don't forget to check out the new capitalraisershow.com website. Amy, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
The easiest way is to go to my website, which is TM, the number one, so TM1, properties, plural, properties.com. So that's how you get a hold of me. You can check me out. You can register and invest. You can book a call with me. You can do whatever from my website.
Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or aspiring fund manager?
The hardest thing you're ever going to have to do is talk to an investor. So don't be afraid to fail. Just go talk to 1,000 of them. And you will learn so much by talking to other investors. That's probably your education more than paying somebody or reading a book or whatever. Just go talk to a bunch of different investors.
This has been fantastic. I really love this show. Amy, thank you so much for coming on. With that, we're going to sign off. Thank you so much, Amy. You've been a blast. Really informative, awesome topics, covered stuff that we haven't talked about in a little bit. But with that, we're going to wish you a great day.
Woo-woo. Have a good day, y'all.